there exactly the kind of miracle that Lyell had rejected. With his theory of natural selection, Darwin once again out-Lyelled Lyell. Darwin recognized that just as the features of the inorganic world, deltas, river valleys, mountain chains, were brought into being by gradual change, the organic world similarly was subject to constant flux. Ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs, birds and fish, and, most discomforting of all, humans, had come into being through a process of transformation that took place over countless generations. This process, though imperceptibly slow, was, according to Darwin, still very much going on. In biology, as in geology, the present was the key to the past. In one of the most often quoted passages of On the Origin of Species, Darwin wrote, "It may be said that natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing, throughout the world, every variation, even the slightest, rejecting that which is bad, preserving and adding up all that is good, silently and insensibly working whenever and wherever opportunity offers." Natural selection eliminated the need for any sort of creative miracles. Given enough time for every variation, even the slightest, to accumulate, new species would emerge from the old. Lyell this time was not so quick to applaud his protege's work. He only grudgingly accepted Darwin's theory of descent with modification, so grudgingly that his stance seems to have eventually ruined their friendship. Darwin's theory about how species originated doubled as a theory of how they vanished. Extinction and evolution were to each other the warp and weft of life's fabric, or, if you prefer, two sides of the same coin. The appearance of new forms and the disappearance of old forms were, Darwin wrote, bound together. Driving both was the struggle for existence, which rewarded the fit and eliminated the less so. The theory of natural selection is grounded on the belief that each new variety, and ultimately each new species, is produced and maintained by having some advantage over those with which it comes into competition, and the consequent extinction of less favored forms almost inevitably follows. Darwin used the analogy of domestic cattle. When a more vigorous or productive variety was introduced, it quickly supplanted other breeds. In Yorkshire, for example, he pointed out, it is historically known that the ancient black cattle were displaced by the longhorns, and that these were subsequently swept away by the shorthorns, as if by some murderous pestilence. Darwin stressed the simplicity of his account. Natural selection was such a powerful force that none other was needed. Along with miraculous origins, world-altering catastrophes could be dispensed with. The whole subject of the extinction of species has been involved in the most gratuitous mystery, he wrote, implicitly mocking Cuvier. From Darwin's premises, an important prediction followed. If extinction was driven by natural selection, and only by natural selection, the two processes had to proceed at roughly the same rate. If anything, extinction had to occur more gradually. The complete extinction of the species of a group is generally a slower process than their production, he observed at one point. No one had ever seen a new species produced, nor, according to Darwin, should they expect to. Speciation was so drawn out as to be, for all intents and purposes, unobservable. "We see nothing of these slow changes in progress," he wrote. It stood to reason that extinction should have been that much more difficult to witness. And yet it wasn't. In fact, during the years Darwin spent holed up at Down House, developing his ideas about evolution, the very last individuals of one of Europe's most celebrated species, the great auk, disappeared. What's more, the event was painstakingly chronicled by British ornithologists. Here, Darwin's theory was directly contradicted by the facts, with potentially profound implications. The Icelandic Institute of Natural History occupies a new building on a lonely hillside outside Reykjavik. The building has a tilted roof and tilted glass walls and looks a bit like the prow of a ship. It was designed as a research facility with no public access, which means that a special appointment is needed to see any of the specimens in the Institute's collection. These specimens, as I learned on the day of my own appointment, include a stuffed tiger, a stuffed kangaroo, and a cabinet full of stuffed birds of paradise. The reason I'd arranged to visit the Institute was to see its great auk. Iceland enjoys the dubious distinction of being the bird's last known home, and the specimen I'd come to look at was killed somewhere in the country, no one is sure of the exact spot, in the summer of 1821. The bird's carcass was purchased by a Danish count, Frederick Christian Rabin, who had come to Iceland expressly to acquire an auk for his collection and had nearly drowned in the attempt. Rabin took the specimen home to his castle, and it remained in private hands until 1971, when it came up for auction in London. The Institute of Natural History solicited donations, and within 3 days, Icelanders contributed the equivalent of 10,000 British pounds to buy the auk back. One woman I spoke to, who was 10 years old at the time, recalled emptying her piggy bank for the effort. Icelandair provided 2 free seats for the homecoming, one for the Institute's director, and the other for the boxed bird. Guðmundur Guðmundsson, who's now the Institute's deputy director, had been assigned the task of showing me the auk. Guðmundsson is an expert on foraminifera, tiny marine creatures that form intricately shaped shells known as testes. On our way to see the bird, we stopped at his office, which was filled with boxes of little glass tubes, each containing a sampling of testes that rattled like sprinkles when I picked it up. Guðmundsson told me that in his spare time, he did translating. A few years ago, he had completed the first Icelandic rendering of On the Origin of Species. He'd found Darwin's prose quite difficult. Sentences inside sentences inside sentences. And the book, Upruni te Hundana, had not sold well, perhaps because so many Icelanders are fluent in English. We made our way to the storeroom for the Institute's collection. The stuffed tiger, wrapped in plastic, looked ready to lunge at the stuffed kangaroo. The great auk, Pinguinus impennis, was standing off by itself, in a specially made plexiglass case. It was perched on a fake rock, next to a fake egg. As the name suggests, the great auk was a large bird. Adults grew to be more than 2.5 feet tall. The auk could not fly. It was one of the few flightless birds of the Northern Hemisphere, and its stubby wings were almost comically undersized for its body. The auk in the case had brown feathers on its back. Probably these were black when the bird was alive, but had since faded. UV light, Guðmundsson said gloomily. It destroys the plumage. The auk's chest feathers were white, and there was a white spot just beneath each eye. The bird had been stuffed with its most distinctive feature, its large, intricately grooved beak, tipped slightly into the air. This lent it a look of mournful hauteur. Guðmundsson explained that the great auk had been on display in Reykjavik until 2008, when the Institute was restructured by the Icelandic government. At that point, another agency was supposed to create a new home for the bird, but various mishaps, including Iceland's financial crisis, had prevented this from happening, which is why Count Rabin's auk was sitting on its fake rock in the corner of the storeroom. On the rock, there was a painted inscription, which Guomundsen translated for me. The bird who was here for show was killed in 1821. It is one of the few great auks that still exist. In its heyday, which is to say before humans figured out how to reach its nesting grounds, the great auk ranged from Norway over to Newfoundland and from Italy to Florida, and its population probably numbered in the millions. When the first settlers arrived in Iceland from Scandinavia, great auks were so common that they were regularly eaten for dinner, and their remains have been found in the 10th century equivalent of household trash. While I was in Reykjavik, I visited a museum built over the ruins of what's believed to be one of the most ancient structures in Iceland, a longhouse constructed out of strips of turf. According to one of the museum's displays, the great auk was easy prey for Iceland's medieval inhabitants. In addition to a pair of auk bones, the display featured a video recreation of an early encounter between man and bird. In the video, a shadowy figure crept along a rocky shore toward a shadowy auk. When he drew close enough, the figure pulled out a stick and clubbed the animal over the head. The auk responded with a cry somewhere between a honk and a grunt. I found the video grimly fascinating and watched it play through a half dozen times. Creep, clobber, squawk, repeat. As best as can be determined, great auks lived much as penguins do. In fact, great auks were the original penguins. They were called this. The etymology of penguin is obscure and may or may not be traced to the Latin pinguis, meaning fat, by European sailors who encountered them in the North Atlantic. Later, when subsequent generations of sailors met similar-colored flightless birds in the southern hemisphere, they used the same name, which led to much confusion, since auks and penguins belong to entirely different families. Penguins constitute their own family, while auks are members of the family that includes puffins and guillemots. Genetic analysis has shown that razorbills are the great auks' closest living relatives. Like penguins, great auks were fantastic swimmers. Eyewitness accounts attest to the bird's astonishing velocity in the water, and they spent most of their lives at sea. But during breeding season, in May and June, they waddled ashore in huge numbers, and here lay their vulnerability. Native Americans clearly hunted the great auk. One ancient grave in Canada was found to contain more than 100 great auk beaks, as did Paleolithic Europeans. Great auk bones have been found at archaeological sites in, among other places, Denmark, Sweden, Spain, Italy, and Gibraltar. By the time the first settlers got to Iceland, many of its breeding sites had already been plundered, and its range was probably much reduced. Then came the wholesale slaughter. Lured by the rich cod fishery, Europeans began making regular voyages to Newfoundland in the early 16th century. Along the way, they encountered a slab of pinkish granite about 50 acres in area, which rose just above the waves. In the spring, the slab was covered with birds, standing, in a manner of speaking, shoulder to shoulder. Many of these were gannets and guillemots. The rest were great auks. The slab, about 40 miles off Newfoundland's northeast coast, became known as the Isle of Birds, or, in some accounts, Penguin Island. Today, it is known as Funk Island. Toward the end of a long transatlantic journey, when provisions were running low, fresh meat was prized, and the ease with which auks could be picked off the slab was soon noted. In an account from 1534, the French explorer Jacques Cartier wrote that some of the Isle of Birds' inhabitants were as large as geese. They are always in the water, not being able to fly in the air, inasmuch as they have only small wings, with which they move as quickly along the water as the other birds fly through the air. And these birds are so fat, it is marvelous. In less than half an hour we filled two boats full of them, as if they had been stones, so that besides them which we did not eat fresh, every ship did powder and salt 5 or 6 barrels full of them. A British expedition that landed on the island a few years later found it full of great fowls. The men drove a great number of the fowls into their ships and pronounced the results to be quite tasty, very good and nourishing meat. A 1622 account by a captain named Richard Whitbourne describes great auks being driven onto boats by hundreds at a time, as if God had made the innocency of so poor a creature to become such an admirable instrument for the sustenance of man. Over the next several decades, other uses for the great auk were found besides sustenance. As one chronicler observed, the great auks of Funk Island were exploited in every way that human ingenuity could devise. Auks were used as fish bait, as a source of feathers for stuffing mattresses, and as fuel. Stone pens were erected on Funk Island. Vestiges of these are still visible today, and the birds were herded into the enclosures until someone could find time to butcher them. Or not. According to an English seaman named Aaron Thomas, who sailed to Newfoundland on the HMS Boston, "If you come for their feathers, you do not give yourself the trouble of killing them, but lay hold of one and pluck the best of the feathers. You then turn the poor penguin adrift, with his skin half naked and torn off, to perish at his leisure." There are no trees on Funk Island, and hence nothing to burn. This led to another practice chronicled by Thomas. "You take a kettle with you into which you put a penguin or two, you kindle a fire under it, and this fire is absolutely made of the unfortunate penguins themselves. Their bodies being oily soon produce a flame." It's been estimated that when Europeans first landed at Funk Island, they found as many as 100,000 pairs of great auks, tending to 100,000 eggs. Probably great auks produced only one egg a year. These were about 5 inches long and speckled, Jackson Pollock-like, in brown and black. Certainly the island's breeding colony must have been a large one, to persist through more than 2 centuries of depredation. By the late 1700s, though, the birds' numbers were in sharp decline. The feather trade had become so lucrative that teams of men were spending the entire summer on Funk, scalding and plucking. In 1785, George Cartwright, an English trader and explorer, observed of these teams, "The destruction which they have made is incredible. If a stop were not soon put to their efforts," he predicted, "the great auk would soon be diminished to almost nothing." Whether the teams actually managed to kill off every last one of the island's auks, or whether the slaughter simply reduced the colony to the point that it became vulnerable to other forces, is unclear. Diminishing population density may have made survival less likely for the remaining individuals, a phenomenon that's known as the Allee effect. In any event, the date that's usually given for the extirpation of the great auk from North America is 1800. Some 30 years later, while working on the Birds of America, John James Audubon traveled to Newfoundland in search of great auks to paint from life. He couldn't find any, and for his illustration had to make do with a stuffed bird from Iceland that had been acquired by a dealer in London. In his description of the great auk, Audubon wrote that it was rare and accidental on the banks of Newfoundland, and that it was said to breed on a rock on that island, a curious contradiction, since no breeding bird can be said to be accidental. Once the Funk Island birds had been salted, plucked, and deep-fried into oblivion, there was only one sizable colony of great auks left in the world, on an island called the Geifugloskir, or Great Auk Skerry, which lay about 30 miles off southwestern Iceland's Reykjanes Peninsula. Much to the auks' misfortune, a volcanic eruption destroyed the Geifugloskir in 1830. This left the birds one solitary refuge, a speck of an island known as Eldi. By this point, the great auk was facing a new threat, its own rarity. Skins and eggs were avidly sought by gentlemen, like Count Rabin, who wanted to fill out their collections. It was in the service of such enthusiasts that the very last known pair of auks was killed on Eldi in 1844. Before setting out for Iceland, I'd decided that I wanted to see the site of the auk's last stand. Eldi is only about 10 miles off the Reykjanes Peninsula, which is just south of Reykjavik. But getting out to the island proved to be way more difficult to arrange than I'd imagined. Everyone I contacted in Iceland told me that no one ever went there. Eventually, a friend of mine who's from Iceland got in touch with his father, who's a minister in Reykjavik, who contacted a friend of his who runs a nature center in a tiny town on the peninsula called Sandgerði. The head of the nature center, Reynir Sveinsson, in turn found a fisherman, Haldur Armansson, who said he'd be willing to take me, but only if the weather was fair. If it was rainy or windy, the trip would be too dangerous and nausea-inducing, and he wouldn't want to risk it. Fortunately, the weather on the day we'd fixed turned out to be splendid. I met Sveinsson at the Nature Center, which features an exhibit on a French explorer, Jean-Baptiste Charcot, who died when his ship, the infelicitously named Pourquoi Pas, sunk off Sainte-Gerde in 1936. We walked over to the harbor and found Armansson loading a chest onto his boat, the Stella. He explained that inside the chest was an extra life raft. Regulations, he shrugged. Armansson had also brought along his fishing partner and a cooler filled with soda and cookies. He seemed pleased to be making a trip that didn't involve cod. We motored out of the harbor and headed south, around the Reykjanes Peninsula. It was clear enough that we could see the snow-covered peak of Snæfellsjökull, more than 60 miles away. To English speakers, Snæfellsjökull is probably best known as the spot where, in Jules Verne's A Journey to the Center of the Earth, the hero finds a tunnel through the globe. Eldi, being much shorter than Snæfellsjökull, was not yet visible. Sveinsson explained that Eldi's name means Fire Island. He said that although he'd spent his entire life in the area, he'd never before been out to it. He'd brought along a fancy camera and was shooting pictures more or less continuously. As Sveinsson snapped away, I chatted with Armansson inside the Stella's small cabin. I was intrigued to see that he had dramatically different colored eyes, one blue and one hazel. Usually, he told me, he fished for cod using a long line that extended 6 miles and trailed 12,000 hooks. The baiting of the hooks was his father's job, and it took nearly 2 days. A good catch could weigh more than 7 metric tons. Often, Armansson slept on the Stella, which was equipped with a microwave and 2 skinny berths. After a while, Eldi appeared on the horizon. The island looked like the base of an enormous column, or like a giant pedestal waiting for an even more gigantic statue. When we got within maybe a mile, I could see that the top of the island, which from a distance appeared flat, was actually tilted at about a 10-degree angle. We were approaching from the shorter end, so we could look across the entire surface. It was white, and appeared to be rippling. As we got closer, I realized that the ripples were birds, so many that they seemed to blanket the island. And when we got even closer, I could see that the birds were gannets, elegant creatures with long necks, cream-colored heads, and tapered beaks. Sveinsson explained that Eldi was home to one of the world's largest colonies of northern gannets, some 30,000 pairs. He pointed out a pyramid-like structure atop the island. This was a platform for a webcam that Iceland's environmental agency had set up. It was supposed to stream a live feed of the Gannets to bird watchers, but it had not functioned as planned. "The birds do not like this camera," Svensson said, "so they fly over it and shit on it." The guano from 30,000 Gannet pairs has given the island what looks like a coating of vanilla frosting. Because of the Gannets, and perhaps also because of the island's history, visitors are not allowed to step onto Eldi without special and hard-to-obtain permits. When I first learned this, I was disappointed. But when we got right up to the island, and I saw the way the sea beat against the cliffs, I felt relieved. The last people to see Great Auk alive were around a dozen Icelanders who made the trip to Eldi by rowboat. They set out one evening in June 1844, rowed through the night, and reached the island the following morning. With some difficulty, three of the men managed to clamber ashore at the only possible landing spot, a shallow shelf of rock that extends from the island to the northeast. A fourth man, who was supposed to go with them, refused to on the grounds that it was too dangerous. By this point, the island's total auk population, probably never very numerous, appears to have consisted of a single pair of birds and one egg. On catching sight of the humans, the birds tried to run, but they were too slow. Within minutes, the Icelanders had captured the auks and strangled them. The egg, they saw, had been cracked, presumably in the course of the chase, so they left it behind. Two of the men were able to jump back into the boat. The third had to be hauled through the waves with a rope. The details of the great auk's last moments, including the names of the men who killed the birds, Sigurdur Islefsson, Ketil Ketilsson, and Jon Branson, are known because 14 years later, in the summer of 1858, two British naturalists traveled to Iceland in search of auks. The older of these, John Woolley, was a doctor and an avid egg collector. The younger, Alfred Newton, was a fellow at Cambridge and soon to be the university's first professor of zoology. The pair spent several weeks on the Reykjanes Peninsula, not far from the site of what is now Iceland's international airport, and during that time, they seemed to have talked to just about everyone who had ever seen an auk, or even just heard about one, including several of the men who'd made the 1844 expedition. The pair of birds that had been killed in that outing, they discovered, had been sold to a dealer for the equivalent of about £9. The birds' innards had been sent to the Royal Museum in Copenhagen. No one could say what had happened to the skins. Subsequent detective work has traced the skin of the female to an auk now on display at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles. Woolley and Newton hoped to get out to Eldi themselves. Wretched weather prevented them. Boats and men were engaged, and stores laid in, but not a single opportunity occurred when a landing would have been practicable, Newton would later write. "It was with heavy hearts that we witnessed the season wearing away." Woolley died shortly after the pair returned to England. For Newton, the experience of the trip would prove to be life-altering. He concluded that the auk was gone. "For all practical purposes, therefore, we may speak of it as a thing of the past," and he developed what one biographer referred to as a peculiar attraction to extinct and disappearing faunas. Newton realized that the birds that bred along Britain's long coast were also in danger. He noted that they were being gunned down for sport in great numbers. "The bird that is shot is apparent," he observed, in an address to the British Association for the Advancement of Science. "We take advantage of its most sacred instincts to waylay it, and in depriving the parent of life, we doom the helpless offspring to the most miserable of deaths, that by hunger. If this is not cruelty, what is?" Newton argued for a ban on hunting during breeding season, and his lobbying resulted in one of the first laws aimed at what today would be called wildlife protection. The Act for the Preservation of Seabirds. As it happens, Darwin's first paper on natural selection appeared in print just as Newton was returning home from Iceland. The paper, in the Journal of the Proceedings of the Linnaean Society, had, with Lyell's help, been published in a rush soon after Darwin had learned that a young naturalist named Alfred Russel Wallace was onto a similar idea. A paper by Wallace appeared in the same issue of the journal. Newton read Darwin's essay very soon after it came out, staying up late into the night to finish it, and he immediately became a convert. "It came to me like the direct revelation of a higher power," he later recalled, "and I awoke next morning with the consciousness that there was an end of all the mystery in the simple phrase, natural selection." He had, he wrote to a friend, developed a case of pure and unmitigated Darwinism. A few years later, Newton and Darwin became correspondents. At one point, Newton sent Darwin a diseased partridge's foot that he thought might be of interest to him, and eventually the two men paid social calls on each other. Whether the subject of the great auk ever came up in their conversations is unknown. It is not mentioned in Newton and Darwin's surviving correspondence, nor does Darwin allude to the bird or its recent demise in any of his other writings. But Darwin had to be aware of human-caused extinction. In the Galapagos, he had personally witnessed, if not exactly a case of extinction in action, then something very close to it. Darwin's visit to the archipelago took place in the fall of 1835, nearly 4 years into the voyage of the Beagle. On Charles Island, now Floriana, he met an Englishman named Nicholas Lawson, who was the Galapagos acting governor, as well as the warden of a small, rather miserable penal colony. Lawson was full of useful information. Among the facts he related to Darwin was that on each of the islands in the Galapagos, the tortoises had different shaped shells. On this basis, Lawson claimed that he could pronounce from which island any tortoise may have been brought. Lawson also told Darwin that the tortoise's days were numbered. The islands were frequently visited by whaling ships, which carried the huge beasts off as portable provisions. Just a few years earlier, a frigate visiting Charles Island had left with 200 tortoises stowed in its hold. As a result, Darwin noted in his diary, the numbers had been much reduced. By the time of the Beagle's visit, tortoises had become so scarce on Charles Island that Darwin, it seems, did not see a single one. Lawson predicted that Charles's tortoise, known today by the scientific name Chelonoidis elephantopus, would be entirely gone within 20 years. In fact, it probably disappeared in fewer than 10. Whether Chelonoidis elephantopus was a distinct species or a subspecies is still a matter of debate. Darwin's familiarity with human-caused extinction is also clear from On the Origin of Species. In one of the many passages in which he heaps scorn on the catastrophists, he observes that animals inevitably become rare before they become extinct. We know this has been the progress of events with those animals which have been exterminated, either locally or wholly, through man's agency. It's a brief allusion, and in its brevity, suggestive. Darwin assumes that his readers are familiar with such events and already habituated to them. He himself seems to find nothing remarkable or troubling about this. But human-caused extinction is, of course, troubling for many reasons, some of which have to do with Darwin's own theory, and it's puzzling that a writer as shrewd and self-critical as Darwin shouldn't have noticed this. In The Origin, Darwin drew no distinction between man and other organisms. As he and many of his contemporaries recognized, this equivalence was the most radical aspect of his work. Humans, just like any other species, were descended, with modification, from more ancient forebears. Even those qualities that seem to set people apart, language, wisdom, a sense of right and wrong, had evolved in the same manner as other adaptive traits, such as longer beaks or sharper incisors. At the heart of Darwin's theory, as one of his biographers has put it, is the denial of humanity's special status. And what was true of evolution should also hold for extinction, since according to Darwin, the latter was merely a side effect of the former. Species were annihilated, just as they were created, by slow-acting and still-existing causes, which is to say, through competition and natural selection. To invoke any other mechanism was nothing more than mystification. But how then to make sense of cases like the great auk, or the Charles Island tortoise, or, to continue the list, the dodo, or the Steller's sea cow? These animals had obviously not been done in by a rival species gradually evolving some competitive advantage. They had all been killed off by the same species, and all quite suddenly. In the case of the great auk and the Charles Island tortoise, over the course of Darwin's own lifetime. Either there had to be a separate category for human-caused extinction, in which case people really did deserve their special status as a creature outside of nature, or space in the natural order had to be made for cataclysm, in which case Cuvier, distressingly, was right. Chapter 4. The Luck of the Ammonites. Discoscophytes jerseyensis. The hill town of Gubbio, about 100 miles north of Rome, might be described as a municipal fossil. Its streets are so narrow that on many of them not even the tiniest Fiat has room to maneuver, and its gray stone piazzas look much as they did in Dante's era. In fact, it was a powerful Gubbian, installed as Lord Mayor of Florence, who engineered Dante's exile in 1302. If you visit in winter, as I did, when the tourists are gone, the hotel shuttered, and the town's picture book palace deserted, it almost seems as if Gubbio has fallen under a spell and is waiting to be awoken. Just beyond the edge of town, a narrow gorge leads off to the northeast. The walls of the gorge, which is known as the Gola del Botticione, consist of bands of limestone that run in diagonal stripes. Long before people settled the region, long before people existed, Gubbio lay at the bottom of a clear, blue sea. The remains of tiny marine creatures rained down on the floor of that sea, building up year after year, century after century, millennium after millennium. In the uplift that created the Apennine Mountains, the limestone was elevated and tilted at a 45-degree angle. To walk up the gorge today is thus to travel layer by layer through time. In the space of a few hundred yards, you can cover almost 100 million years. The Gola del Botticione is now a tourist destination in its own right, though for a more specialized crowd. It is here that in the late 1970s, a geologist named Walter Alvarez, who had come to study the origins of the Apennines, ended up, more or less by accident, rewriting the history of life. In the gorge, he discovered the first traces of the giant asteroid that ended the Cretaceous period and caused what may have been the worst day ever on planet Earth. By the time the dust, in this case literal as much as figurative, had settled, some 3/4 of all species had been wiped out. The evidence of the asteroid's impact lies in a thin layer of clay about halfway up the gorge. Sightseers can park at a turnoff constructed nearby. There's also a little kiosk explaining in Italian the site's significance. The clay layer is easy to spot. It's been gouged out by hundreds of fingers, a bit like the toes of the bronze St. Peter in Rome, worn down by the kisses of pilgrims. The day I visited was gray and blustery, and I had the place to myself. I wondered what had prompted all that fingering. Was it simple curiosity? A form of geologic rubbernecking? Or was it something more empathetic? The desire to make contact, however attenuated, with a lost world. I, too, of course, had to stick my finger in. I poked around in the groove and scraped out a pebble-sized piece of clay. It was the color of worn brick and the consistency of dried mud. I put it in an old candy wrapper and stuck it in my pocket, my own little chunk of planetary disaster. Walter Alvarez came from a long line of distinguished scientists. His great-grandfather and grandfather were both noted physicians, and his father, Luis, was a physicist at the University of California, Berkeley. But it was his mother who took him for long walks in the Berkeley Hills and got him interested in geology. Walter attended graduate school at Princeton, then went to work for the oil industry. He was living in Libya when Muammar Gaddafi took over the country in 1969. A few years later, he got a research post at the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory, across the Hudson from Manhattan. At the time, what's sometimes called the plate tectonics revolution was sweeping through the profession, and just about everyone at Lamont got swept up in it. Alvarez decided to try to figure out how, on the basis of plate tectonics, the Italian peninsula had come into being. Key to the project was a kind of reddish limestone, known as the Scalia Rosso, which can be found, among other places, in the Gola del Bottacione. The project moved forward, got stuck, and shifted direction. In science, sometimes it's better to be lucky than smart, he would later say of these events. Eventually, he found himself working in Gubbio with an Italian geologist named Isabella Premoli Silva, who was an expert on foraminifera. Foraminifera, or forams for short, are the tiny marine creatures that create little calcite shells, or testes, which drift down to the ocean floor once the animal inside has died. The testes have a distinctive shape, which varies from species to species. Some look, under magnification, like beehives, others like braids or bubbles or clusters of grapes. Forams tend to be widely distributed and abundantly preserved, and this makes them extremely useful as index fossils. On the basis of which species of forams are found in a given layer of rock, an expert like Silva can tell the rock's age. As they worked their way up the Gola del Bottacione, Silva pointed out to Alvarez a curious sequence. The limestone from the last stage of the Cretaceous period contained diverse, abundant, and relatively large forams, many as big as grains of sand. Directly above that, there was a layer of clay, about half an inch thick, with no forams in it. Above the clay, there was limestone with more forams, but these belonged to only a handful of species, all of them very tiny, and all totally different from the larger ones below. Alvarez had been schooled in, to use his phrase, a kind of hardcore uniformitarianism. He'd been trained to believe, after Lyell and Darwin, that the disappearance of any group of organisms had to be a gradual process, with one species slowly dying out, then another, then a third, and so on. Looking at the sequence in the Gubbio limestone, though, he saw something different. The many species of forams in the lower layer seemed to disappear suddenly, and all more or less at the same time. The whole process, Alvarez would later recall, certainly looked very abrupt. Then there was the odd matter of timing. The king-sized forams appeared to vanish right around the point the last of the dinosaurs were known to have died off. This struck Alvarez as more than just a coincidence. He thought it would be interesting to know exactly how much time that half-inch of clay represented. In 1977, Alvarez got a job at Berkeley, where his father, Luis, was still working, and he brought with him to California his samples from Gubbio. While Walter had been studying plate tectonics, Luis had won a Nobel Prize. He'd also developed the first linear proton accelerator, invented a new kind of bubble chamber, designed several innovative radar systems, and co-discovered tritium. Around Berkeley, Luis had become known as the Wild Idea Man. Intrigued by a debate over whether there were treasure-filled chambers inside Egypt's second-largest pyramid, he'd at one point designed a test that required installing a muon detector in the desert. The detector showed that the pyramid was, in fact, solid rock. At another point, he'd become interested in the Kennedy assassination and had performed an experiment that involved wrapping cantaloupes in shipping tape and shooting them with a rifle. The experiment demonstrated that the movement of the president's head after he was hit was consistent with the findings of the Warren Commission. When Walter told his father about the puzzle from Gubbio, Luis was fascinated. It was Luis who came up with the wild idea of clocking the clay using the element iridium. Iridium is extremely rare on the surface of the Earth, but much more common in meteorites. In the form of microscopic grains of cosmic dust, bits of meteorites are constantly raining down on the planet. Luis reasoned that the longer it had taken the clay layer to accumulate, the more cosmic dust would have fallen. Thus, the more iridium it would contain. He contacted a Berkeley colleague, Frank Asaro, whose lab was one of the few with the right kind of equipment for this sort of analysis. Asaro agreed to run tests on a dozen samples, though he said he very much doubted anything would come of it. Walter gave him some limestone from above the clay layer, some from below it, and some of the clay itself. Then he waited. 9 months later, he got a call. There was something seriously wrong with the samples from the clay layer. The amount of iridium in them was off the charts. No one knew what to make of this. Was it a weird anomaly or something more significant? Walter flew to Denmark to collect some late Cretaceous sediments from a set of limestone cliffs known as Stevens Klint. At Stevens Klint, the end of the Cretaceous period shows up as a layer of clay that's jet black and smells like dead fish. When the stinky Danish samples were analyzed, they too revealed astronomical levels of iridium. A third set of samples from the South Island of New Zealand also showed an iridium spike right at the end of the Cretaceous. Luis, according to a colleague, reacted to the news like a shark smelling blood. He sensed the opportunity for a great discovery. The Alvarezes batted around theories, but all the ones they could think of either didn't fit the available data or were ruled out by further tests. Then, finally, after almost a year's worth of dead ends, they arrived at the impact hypothesis. On an otherwise ordinary day, 65 million years ago, an asteroid 6 miles wide collided with the Earth. Exploding on contact, it released energy on the order of 100 million megatons of TNT, or more than a million of the most powerful H-bombs ever tested. Debris, including iridium from the pulverized asteroid, spread around the globe. Day turned to night, and temperatures plunged. A mass extinction ensued. The Alvarezes wrote up the results from Gubbio and Stevens Klint and sent them, along with their proposed explanation, to Science. I can remember working very hard to make that paper just as solid as it could possibly be, Walter told me. The Alvarez's paper, Extraterrestrial Cause for the Cretaceous Tertiary Extinction, was published in June 1980. It generated lots of excitement, much of it beyond the bounds of paleontology. Journals in disciplines ranging from clinical psychology to herpetology reported on the Alvarez's findings, and soon the idea of an end Cretaceous asteroid was picked up by magazines like Time and Newsweek. One commentator observed that to connect the dinosaurs, creatures of interest to but the veriest dullards, with a spectacular extraterrestrial event seemed like one of those plots a clever publisher might concoct to guarantee sales. Inspired by the impact hypothesis, a group of astrophysicists led by Carl Sagan decided to try to model the effects of an all-out war and came up with the concept of nuclear winter, which in turn generated its own wave of media coverage. But among professional paleontologists, the Alvarez's idea, and in many cases the Alvarez's themselves, were reviled. The apparent mass extinction is an artifact of statistics and poor understanding of the taxonomy, one paleontologist told the New York Times. The arrogance of those people is unbelievable, a second asserted. They know next to nothing about how real animals evolve, live, and become extinct. But despite their ignorance, the geochemists feel that all you have to do is crank up some fancy machine and you've revolutionized science. Unseen bolides dropping into unseen seas are not for me, a third declared. The Cretaceous extinctions were gradual, and the catastrophe theory is wrong, yet another paleontologist stated. But simplistic theories will continue to come along to seduce a few scientists and enliven the covers of popular magazines. Curiously enough, the Times editorial board decided to weigh in on the matter. Astronomers should leave to astrologers the task of seeking the cause of earthly events in the stars, the paper admonished. To understand the vehemence of this reaction, it helps to go back, once again, to Lyell. In the fossil record, mass extinctions stand out, so much so that the very language that's used to describe Earth's history is derived from them. In 1841, John Phillips, a contemporary of Lyell's, who succeeded him as president of the Geological Society of London, divided life into three chapters. He called the first the Paleozoic, from the Greek for ancient life, the second the Mesozoic, meaning middle life, and the third the Cenozoic, new life. Phillips fixed as the dividing point between the Paleozoic and the Mesozoic what would now be called the end Permian extinction, and between the Mesozoic and the Cenozoic, the end Cretaceous event. In geologic parlance, the Paleozoic, Mesozoic, and Cenozoic are eras, and each era comprises several periods. The Mesozoic, for example, spans the Triassic, the Jurassic, and the Cretaceous. The fossils from the three eras were so different that Phillips thought they represented distinct acts of creation. Lyell was well aware of these breaks in the fossil record. In the third volume of the Principles of Geology, he noted a chasm between the plants and animals found in rocks from the late Cretaceous period and those found directly above, at the start of the Tertiary period, which is now technically known as the beginning of the Paleogene. For instance, late Cretaceous deposits contained the remains of numerous species of belemnites, squid-like creatures that left behind fossils shaped like bullet casings. But belemnite fossils were never found in more recent deposits. The same pattern held for ammonites and for rudest bivalves, mollusks that formed immense reefs. Rudists have been described as oysters pretending to be corals. To Lyell, it was simply impossible, or unphilosophical, to imagine that this chasm represented what it seemed to, sudden and dramatic global change. So, in a rather neat bit of circular reasoning, he asserted that the faunal gap was just a gap in the fossil record. After comparing the life forms on both sides of the supposed gap, Lyell concluded that the unaccounted-for interval must have been a long one, roughly equivalent to all the time that had passed since the record had resumed. Using today's dating methods, the lacuna he was positing amounts to some 65 million years. Darwin, too, was well informed about the discontinuity at the end of the Cretaceous. In The Origin, he observed that the disappearance of the ammonites seemed to be wonderfully sudden. And, just like Lyell, he dismissed the ammonites and what they seemed to be saying. For my part, he observed, I look at the natural geological record as a history of the world imperfectly kept, and written in a changing dialect. Of this history we possess the last volume alone, relating only to two or three countries. Of this volume, only here and there a short chapter has been preserved, and of each page, only here and there a few lines. The fragmentary nature of the record meant that the semblance of abrupt change was just that. With respect to the apparently sudden extermination of whole families or orders, it must be remembered, he wrote, that wide intervals of time were probably unaccounted for. Had the evidence of these intervals not been lost, it would have shown much slow extermination. In this way, Darwin continued the Lyellian project of turning the geologic evidence on its head. So profound is our ignorance, and so high our presumption, that we marvel when we hear of the extinction of an organic being, and as we do not see the cause, we invoke cataclysms to desolate the world, he declared. Darwin's successors inherited the much slow extermination problem. The uniformitarian view precluded sudden or sweeping change of any kind. But the more that was learned about the fossil record, the more difficult it was to maintain that an entire age, spanning tens of millions of years, had somehow or other gone missing. This growing tension led to a series of increasingly tortured explanations. Perhaps there had been some sort of crisis at the close of the Cretaceous, but it had to have been a very slow crisis. Maybe the losses at the end of the period did constitute a mass extinction. But mass extinctions were not to be confused with catastrophes. The same year that the Alvarezes published their paper in Science, George Gaylord Simpson, at the time probably the world's most influential paleontologist, wrote that the turnover at the end of the Cretaceous should be regarded as part of a long and essentially continuous process. In the context of hardcore uniformitarianism, the impact hypothesis was worse than wrong. The Alvarezes were claiming to explain an event that hadn't happened, one that couldn't have happened. It was like peddling patent medicine for a fictitious illness. A few years after father and son published their hypothesis, an informal survey was conducted at a meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. A majority of those surveyed said they thought some sort of cosmic collision might have taken place, but only 1 in 20 thought it had anything to do with the extinction of the dinosaurs. One paleontologist at the meeting labeled the Alvarez hypothesis codswallop. Meanwhile, evidence for the hypothesis continued to accumulate. The first independent corroboration came in the form of tiny grains of rock known as shocked quartz. Under high magnification, shocked quartz exhibits what look like scratch marks, the result of bursts of high pressure that deform the crystal structure. Shocked quartz was first noted at nuclear test sites and subsequently found in the immediate vicinity of impact craters. In 1984, grains of shocked quartz were discovered in a layer of clay from the Cretaceous Tertiary, or KT boundary, in eastern Montana. K is used as the abbreviation for Cretaceous because C was already taken by the Carboniferous. Today, the border is formally known as the Cretaceous Paleogene, or KPG, boundary. The next clue showed up in South Texas, in a curious layer of end Cretaceous sandstone that seemed to have been produced by an enormous tsunami. It occurred to Walter Alvarez that if there had been a giant impact-induced tsunami, it would have scoured away shorelines, leaving behind a distinctive fingerprint in the sedimentary record. He scanned the records of thousands of sediment cores that had been drilled in the oceans and found such a fingerprint in cores from the Gulf of Mexico. Finally, 100-mile-wide crater was discovered, or more accurately, rediscovered, beneath the Yucatan Peninsula. Buried under half a mile of newer sediment, the crater had shown up in gravity surveys taken in the 1950s by Mexico's state-run oil company. Company geologists had interpreted it as the traces of an underwater volcano, and, since volcanoes don't yield oil, prompt